Welcome back to Runtime AI Security. This is episode 5, our last one in this series on the book Zero Trust and Sandbox Isolation. Over the previous 4 episodes, we built up a fairly uncomfortable picture. We started with the thesis that author trust and sandbox isolation are orthogonal concepts. We looked at how attackers jump the sandbox without ever touching the sandbox itself. We covered impersonation, time bombs, and legal loopholes. And last time we talked about attaching as a callee, running defensive probes against your own trust machinery. Today we assemble all of it into what the book calls the Secure Boundary Model and its 13 principles.
That's right, and I think the framing matters here. The first 3 chapters are essentially a demolition job. They take every trust signal that a platform might rely on and show how it can be forged, compromised, or manipulated. Chapter 4 is the reconstruction. It says, given that all of those signals are unreliable as security controls, what does a defensible architecture actually look like? And the answer the book gives is a set of 13 principles that keep the security boundary anchored in zero trust, behavioral monitoring, and cryptographic verification.
13 is a lot to hold in your head at once. Is there a hierarchy? Does one of them matter more than the others?
Yes, and the book is explicit about it. The zero trust baseline is the cornerstone. Everything else is built on top of it. The principle states that all skills start with the minimum possible permissions, regardless of the author's reputation, endorsement, or historical trust. The sandbox applies identical isolation parameters to every skill. Author trust signals are used solely for user education and risk communication. They never grant elevated privileges. They never bypass sandbox restrictions, and they never relax any security control. The book puts it very plainly. Without this principle, every other control can be undermined by a sufficiently convincing trust signal.
Say more about that last part, because that's the crux, isn't it? If you get the baseline wrong, the other 12 principles don't save you.
Correct. Think about what a trust signal is. It's an input. If your policy engine treats that input as authoritative for permission decisions, then an attacker's job reduces to producing a convincing input. You can have world-class cryptographic supply chain verification, excellent behavioral monitoring, a great audit trail, and none of it matters if there's a code path that says, "This publisher is verified, therefore relax the isolation." The attacker will find that code path and aim at it. That's why the baseline has to be uniform. Identical isolation parameters for every skill, full stop.
And the trust score still exists in this model. It just does a different job.
Exactly. This is the second principle, trust signals as informational. You still compute a score. You still show it to the user in the permission prompt. It helps them make an informed decision. What it must never do is alter the actual sandbox restrictions. The book calls the mechanism policy enforcement separation. The scoring engine and the permission enforcement engine are separate concerns, and the arrow only points one direction, toward the user, never toward the enforcer.
Let's move to the third principle, because this one is going to be unpopular with anyone who's ever built a user experience. No persistent trust grants.
It is unpopular, and the book anticipates that. The principle says all permissions are per session and per skill. There is no permanent allow for trusted publishers. Each invocation requires fresh permission validation. And closely tied to it is the 11th principle, no exception mechanism. The sandbox must have no override or exception based on author trust. All permissions are governed by the same strict isolation rules.
The obvious objection is friction. If a user has to reapprove the same skill every session, aren't you just training them to click yes reflexively?
That's a real tension, and I won't pretend the book resolves it with a magic answer. What it does say is that the temptation to create convenience exceptions for well-known publishers must be resisted, because those exceptions are precisely the attack surface that sophisticated adversaries will target. Think about it from the attacker's side. If there's a button that says, "Allow this publisher," and that button grants persistent, elevated permissions, then the entire attack chain we described in earlier episodes collapses into one objective: become that publisher, or become indistinguishable from them. Account takeover, homoglyph impersonation, certificate abuse, reputation farming. Every one of those vectors terminates at that button. Remove the button, and the payoff for all of those attacks drops dramatically.
So the friction is the point, in a sense. Or at least the friction is the price of removing a very high-value target.
That's a fair way to put it. And the manuscript pairs it with the 12th principle, user education, which is about making that friction meaningful rather than reflexive. The trust score must be accompanied by a plain language explanation of its basis so the user can exercise their own judgment. In Chapter 3, the book describes a trust score transparency module that shows the evidence behind the score. Something like, this author has made 50 previous contributions and has 200 stars. The point is that a prompt with real evidence in it is a different thing from a prompt that just says, trusted, click here.
Let's get to the fourth principle, which I think is the most technically interesting one. Behavioral trust over reputation.
This is where the model gets its teeth. The principle is that actual runtime behavior governs restrictions, not author history. The host evaluates the skill's real behavior during execution, system calls, network activity, file system access, and applies restrictions dynamically. A high-reputation author cannot escape behavioral scrutiny. The skill's behavior is monitored in real time, and any deviation from its declared purpose or from previously observed behavior triggers enhanced sandbox restrictions and alerts.
Connect that back to the time bomb attack we covered in episode 3. Does this actually catch it?
It does, and the book makes that link directly. Recall the scenario: a trusted author, long history, high reputation, whose account has been compromised, and whose latest update contains a delayed payload. Every static trust signal in the system says this is fine. The signature is valid. The reputation is earned. The community endorsements are genuine. None of that helps you. But behavioral monitoring doesn't care about any of it. The moment the payload activates and the skill starts doing something outside its declared purpose, the deviation is observable. The book's phrasing is that even a perfectly trusted author, whose account has been compromised, and whose latest update contains a time bomb, cannot escape detection once the payload activates.
Once the payload activates, though, that's a detection at execution time, not before.
Right, and that's an honest limitation. Behavioral trust is a detection and containment control, not a prevention control, which is exactly why it sits inside a layered model. The eighth principle, continuous behavioral monitoring, is paired with the ninth, incident response and revocation, so that detection has consequences. And in Chapter 3, the book describes continuous behavioral trust scoring, where a skill that behaves benignly earns higher real-time trust, and a skill that starts making unexpected network calls receives lower trust and faces dynamically increased sandbox restrictions. So the response is graduated, not just an alarm bell.
Let's talk about the supply chain side. Principle 5 is cryptographic supply chain verification, and Principle 6 is mandatory hardware attestation.
Principle 5 says every artifact must be cryptographically verified at every stage: source code, build process, dependencies, and final package. The book points to frameworks like SALSA, Supply Chain Levels for Software Artifacts, which provides a checklist of standards and controls to prevent tampering and improve integrity across the software supply chain. It also names SigStore and InToto as part of that key control set. And the critical rule is that any layer without verification triggers heightened sandboxing.
That last rule feels like it's answering a specific attack from Chapter 2.
It is. It's answering signature verification bypass. In Episode 2, we discussed how an attacker can craft a package that passes all cryptographic signature checks while placing the payload in a layer the signature doesn't cover. Using things like Git LFS, submodules, or content fetched at runtime. The defense isn't a better signature. The defense is a policy that says unverified equals untrusted. If a layer isn't covered, you don't shrug and pass it through. You increase the isolation around it.
And hardware attestation. Why does the hardware part matter so much?
Because of the compromised CI/CD pipeline vector. The principle requires that authors attest to the safety of their skill using a hardware-backed security key at publication, something in the FIDO2 or security key family, and that attestation is cryptographically verified by the host. In Chapter 3, the same idea appears as the build pipeline integrity check, which requires the author to sign the final artifact with a hardware key directly, not through CI/CD automation. The reason is stated very cleanly in the book. This requirement ensures that even a fully compromised build system cannot produce a validly attested artifact without physical access to the author's hardware key.
So it breaks the chain that made the SolarWinds pattern work. The attacker owns the build system, but the build system can't manufacture the attestation.
That's the design intent. The book's framing is that attestation cannot be automated away by a compromised pipeline. If the signing is fully automated, then whoever owns the automation owns the signature. Putting a physical key in the loop introduces a step that an infrastructure compromise alone cannot satisfy.
Principle 7 is community review as a supplementary layer. We touched on this in episode 4, but where does it land in the final model?
It lands as a non-authoritative trust signal. Community vetting may increase the user's confidence, but it never lowers the sandbox's technical restrictions. Chapter 3 describes a decentralized community verification mechanism where multiple independent verifiers attest to an author's identity and a skill's safety, with a quorum requirement, something like 5 out of 7, before a skill is considered community vetted. But the book is emphatic that community vetting must never be used as a basis for relaxing sandbox restrictions. And you can see why, given the DAO governance attacks and sock puppet reputation farming we covered earlier. A democratic-looking process can be captured.
Then incident response and revocation, Principle 9. What happens the moment something is confirmed malicious?
The response is deliberately broad. If any skill from an author is found malicious, all other skills from that author are immediately quarantined. All users are alerted to perform a system scan and to revoke any granted permissions. Chapter 3 frames it as an incident response hook that downgrades trust for all of an author's skills, alerts every user who has used them, and revokes all elevated permissions across the entire system.
That's a heavy hammer. Why treat the author as the blast radius rather than the individual skill?
Because if the trust signal that covered one skill has failed, you have no basis for believing it holds for the others. Whether the cause was account takeover, a compromised pipeline, or a long game sleeper, the compromise is at the identity level, not the artifact level. Quarantining author-wide is the consistent conclusion of the model's own logic.
And Principle 10, auditable trust decisions.
All trust-related decisions are logged in a tamper-evident audit trail. Scoring, endorsements, warnings, permission grants, all of it. The key control the book names is an immutable audit log. The purpose is post-incident analysis and accountability. The manuscript says this auditability is essential for understanding how an attack succeeded and for improving the system's defenses. If your trust decisions are invisible, you can detect that you were breached, but you can't reconstruct which signal lied to you.
Which brings us to the 13th principle, red team resilience.
The system must be regularly red teamed to test for trust exploitation vectors, ensuring that even the most sophisticated reputation farming, account takeover, and impersonation attacks cannot bypass the sandbox's technical isolation. And the book is specific that red teaming is not a one-time exercise, but a continuous practice, because attackers continuously develop new techniques to exploit trust signals. This is where the probes from Episode 4 live permanently. Decoy trust manipulation, where you inject a fake trusted author into your own system and watch whether it gets elevated privileges. The trust boundary fuzzer, which impersonates a trusted author at every stage, metadata, signature, commits, endorsements, and validates that isolation does not relax, even when all the signals look valid.
If a listener is running a platform today and can only act on one thing from this episode, what should it be?
Go look for the Allow This Publisher button. Search your permission model, your policy engine, your admin console, and your configuration files for any code path where a signature, a publisher identity, a reputation score, or an endorsement changes a permission outcome. Not changes what the user is shown, changes what the code is allowed to do. That's the policy guard from Chapter 3, stated as a concrete audit. The book's rule is that there must be no Allow This Publisher button that grants persistent elevated permissions, and that all permission grants must be per session and per skill. If you find such a path, you have found the exact thing every attack vector in this book is aimed at. Everything else in the 13 principles is easier to add once that single hole is closed.
Let's close out the whole series then. The book's conclusion, in your words.
The conclusion says that the illusion that a trusted author equates to safe code is one of the most persistent and dangerous vulnerabilities in modern software ecosystems. The structured red team analysis across the book demonstrates that every trust signal, cryptographic signatures, reputation scores, community endorsements, legal disclaimers, and hardware attestations can be forged, compromised, or manipulated by a sufficiently motivated adversary. The only robust defense is to treat author trust as an entirely separate concern from technical isolation, and a secure boundary model anchored in zero trust principles, continuous behavioral monitoring, and rigorous cryptographic verification of the full supply chain is the only way to render reputation-based attacks ineffective and maintain true sandbox integrity.
There's one line in the conclusion that I think summarizes the entire five episodes.
The security boundary must be anchored not in who wrote the code, but in what the code does. Author trust is a starting point for conversation with the user. It is never a basis for granting technical privileges, and the book adds the condition that matters most. When this principle is upheld without exception, the sandbox remains intact, regardless of how sophisticated the attacker's social engineering, how convincing their endorsements, or how long they have been building their reputation. Without exception is the operative phrase. One exception is enough.
That feels like the right place to end. Over five episodes, we went from the orthogonality of trust and isolation, through jumping the sandbox without touching it, through impersonation and time bombs and legal loopholes, through defensive probes attached as a callee, and finally to the 13 principles. My takeaway for the whole series is that the hardest part of this work isn't technical. It's resisting the very reasonable-sounding request to make an exception for someone you have good reason to trust.
That's well put. And the encouraging part is that the model is not exotic. Uniform isolation, per-session permissions, behavioral monitoring, verified supply chain, hardware attestation, honest user communication, continuous red teaming. These are things engineering teams already know how to build. The discipline is in refusing to let a reputation signal reach into the enforcement layer, and in checking, repeatedly and adversarially, that it never has.
Thank you for walking through all of this. That's the end of Runtime AI Security, based on zero trust and sandbox isolation from VerifyClaw.io. If you're building systems that execute third-party code, go read the book's Chapter 4 Table of 13 Principles and treat it as a checklist against your own architecture. Thanks for listening.